losing so much money and funding that'll hurt the very people that these university presidents are trying to protect.
Yeah. Yes. First, let me just address vote. So, you know, he also said we want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. When they wake up in the morning, we want them not to want to go to work, because increasingly we want them viewed as the villains. We want their funding to be shut down. We want them to be put in trauma. So I think that helps us understand the blitzkrieg from political actors right now, is that they really want to put higher education in trauma. That's almost a direct quote from Vogt. So I think that helps sort of contextualize. Now, we have some difficult decisions to make as higher education leaders, as K-12 leaders, some very difficult decisions. Because, as I mentioned, over the last 100 years, universities have become very dependent on solving the world's issues through research. And so that means there's millions of dollars that the federal government has been providing without strings attached. Well, now there's going to be strings attached. But who's to say that diversity is where these conversations stop? So what if after diversity, the question is, well, we don't want you to have unions, or we don't want you to have a college of fine arts because we don't think that that's appropriate. And so when there's strings attached, universities have to make two decisions. One, there'll have to be courage, like the president of Mount Holyoke or the president at Wesleyan in Connecticut, or two, patronage. In talking with some folks, some scholars at the University of Michigan yesterday, there's really those two choices for higher education institutions. There's a side where we're going to have to innovate and rethink how higher education is funded, or we're going to have to succumb to a system of patronage where the federal government, you know, in 4 years, a Democrat might come in as president and say, you won't receive federal funding unless you have DEI programs. So that's really the road we're headed down. And then I think one final thought, which is that when we hire leaders in higher education, we typically look at their pedigree. Did they go to Harvard or Berkeley or Stanford? What were they, department chairs or deans? But now we have to have additional criteria when we're selecting our leaders, our deans, our department chairs. It involves courage. It involves morality. It involves empathy. We need special kinds of leaders in this very difficult time. I would argue that higher education hasn't faced a crisis like this since potentially McCarthyism. So we need a different kind of leader to address these modern challenges also.
And finally, are there lawsuits being planned? There's 1 week to go after this letter.
Yeah. Well, there's already multiple lawsuits. For example, my understanding is that the NIH has been paused in court from a report that I read from President
Ono. The freeze has been paused.
Yeah, the freeze has been paused. Yeah, exactly. So there is. I know that the APLU and the AAU, so these are the conglomerates of the different kinds of institutions, that they're involved in litigation too. I suspect that you'll see litigation from civil rights community, and that's part of the strategy for educators. And I think it's important for us to understand that academics, educators, we have to create alliances with students and engage in political and legal advocacy and research and document and publicize how these things are actually impacting our institutions and who they're impacting. And then I think it's also one final thought is that we have to leverage our professional associations, our organizations, accrediting bodies. There's a reason why accrediting bodies are also being targeted, because accrediting bodies set the standards for universities. So it's very important that we create these coalitions so that as this pressure continues on higher education and K-12, that we can respond, because the number one priority of our institutions is student success. And I don't believe, my argument is that none of this is in the best interest of students.
Julian Vasquez-Heilig, we thank you so much for joining us from Kalamazoo, Michigan, professor of educational leadership, research and technology at Western Michigan University. We'll link to your new piece, U.S. Department of Education's 14-day ultimatum on equal opportunity. Will universities surrender or resist? Up next, erasing history. How fascists rewrite the past to control the future. We'll speak with Yale philosopher Jason Stanley. Back in 20 seconds. world by the interrupters. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to someone who has a deep understanding of the stakes of the Trump administration's assault on education and history. In his latest book, Yale University philosophy professor Jason Stanley details how educational institutions and the teaching of history have become key battlegrounds in authoritarian countries as the Trump administration, through a dizzying series of executive orders and actions, attempts to dismantle higher education in the United States by redefining discrimination in schools, fighting so-called woke ideology, attacking diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, gutting the Department of Education, and threatening funding for research and higher education. We're joined here in New York by Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale. His latest book, Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future, also author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I mean, since your books, you've been writing a lot, and you've been speaking a lot on these issues. If you can take on what's happening right now to the major threat to higher education, whether we're talking about the freezing of funding for pediatric cancer research throughout the United States, is some of the most elite scientific departments at universities, or whether we're talking about erasing DEI. What, give us the context for this.
Well, first of all, there are no liberal arts colleges in authoritarian countries. So if you're transitioning to authoritarianism, you have to target colleges and universities as well as education. As Vladimir Putin recently said, wars are won by teachers. Now, let's be clear. The United States has the world's greatest system of higher education. Everyone in the world who can sends their kids to our colleges and universities if they can be accepted to those universities. Every professor in the world would leave their university if their personal situation would allow to come to a U.S. university if they got an offer. What the Trump administration is trying to do is take this system down. They have various reasons for take. They have various excuses, not reasons. They say universities are packed with Democrats. Well, look, math and physics departments are packed with Democrats. The vast majority of mathematicians and physicists are, in fact, not Trump supporters. So the idea is presumably to stock your local physics department, to stock the top medical schools with Trump supporters just because they're Trump supporters. This takes down the United States as a leading research place. It takes down one of the things that we do unquestionably the best in the world, which is higher ed.
Talk about how exactly you see history being rewritten by the current administration and the impacts it has in your university and others.
Right. So they're targeting, they say they're targeting critical race theory. Critical race theory is the study of the practices that keep racial inequalities present, that are hangovers from Jim Crow. The institution for example, things like mortgage redlining, school segregation, housing segregation, policing practices that were formed when cities were intentionally segregated. So they're targeting black history, they're targeting minority history, and they're trying to replace it explicitly with patriotic education. Now, in just imagine your cartoon vision of an authoritarian country. Imagine 1984. It's a country, the George Orwell's book. It's a country where students pledge allegiance to the flag every day. It's a country where instead of knowledge and learning, they're taught to be, they're indoctrinated. Now, this will be done supposedly under under the banner of classical education. The idea is we're going to restore classical education to end wokeness. But let's look at classical education. Classical education is an education that is whose foundational elements are the works of the ancient philosophers and ancient history, like Thucydides, Plato, and Aristotle. Plato advocated removing children from their family at birth. In Plato's Symposium, it's normal to have relations between older male professors and their younger male students. So the idea that classical education is there to promote Christianity and the nuclear family is simply just delusional. And it's, as usual with this attack on schools and higher education, it's merely an ideological facade for replacing critical inquiry with, saluting the flag.
So talk about this moment. We're talking to you on Friday. You're both a German citizen and a U.S. citizen. You're the son of Holocaust survivors. You don't throw around these words, fascism, Nazism, easily. You know exactly the effects. We're moving into a weekend, an election in Germany. If you can talk about Vice President J.D. Vance recently meeting with the far-right party, Alternative for Germany, AfD leader Alice Weidel. Billionaire Elon Musk sent a message to the AfD's election campaign launch party back in January, which he says there is too much of a focus on past guilt. I want to play that.
The German people are sort of really, really an ancient nation, goes back thousands of years. I was even Julius Caesar's account of like first encountering the German tribes in the Gola campaigns, and he was like, "Wow, very impressive. these are very, very powerful warriors." I think there's like, frankly, too much of a focus on past guilt, and we need to move beyond that. Children should not be guilty of the sins of their parents, or even let alone their parents, their great-grandparents, maybe even.
So that's Elon Musk addressing the AfD on a huge video screen. And, of course, as we just said, Vance just met with the AfD leader. The election is Sunday. Talk about the significance of this.
So in discussions of, for example, black education, Germany is held up as a model of facing its past. And Germany's sort of democracy has been based upon this education system of facing the past. And that was always somewhat fictional. We have to remember that 80 years ago, we're talking about 80 years ago. We're not talking about the 19th century. So Germany had various ways of facing its past and various ways of evading facing its past. But across the world, it was taken as a model. So if you take down Germany's education system, then you take down the world model for doing this. Now, let's be clear. German people of my generation, their grandparents were Nazis. We know now that the Wehrmacht, the German soldiers who fought the ordinary Germans, we know now through research that they participated in mass slaughter. Seven of my great uncles were murdered by the Wehrmacht, and all of their children, my mother and her sister, are the only survivors of their family, of their generation. So this education, flawed as it was, is being targeted now. AfD is running on a platform of glorifying German soldiers in World War I and World War II. That comment of Musk, the German nations were great fighters, that links into AfD's rhetoric and propaganda of reversing, of erasing the past, saying, well, we should be proud of our German soldiers in World War I and World War II. Now, this was always going to be the case. If you attack black history in the United States, if you blur the history of slavery, if you say that slavery was part of what made America great, we don't need to be ashamed of it, that is, of course, going to result in the erasure of Jewish history in Germany. And, you know, Jewish Americans, my fellow Jewish Americans who supported this in the case of black history, erasing black history, this is just coming back to bite them. Musk is not American. He's not from America. He has no commitment to Holocaust history being remembered. This kind of facing your past, as Germany shows, is essential to democracy. It's essential to German democracy.
You know, the Nazi Party was founded in Munich 100 years ago this week, on February 27, 1925. Adolf Hitler delivered a speech to 3,000 people in a Munich beer hall just out of prison for his role in a failed coup. He was relaunching the party and cementing his role as its unquestioned leader. But also out of Munich, Hans and Sophie Scholl, that brother and sister who attended the University of Munich, they weren't even Jewish. They were Christians who felt that the world and Germans had to know so that they could never deny what was happening with the Holocaust, and release those six pamphlets, among them the one that said, "We will not be silent." They would be caught, captured, tried, and beheaded, along with their professor and others. So if you can talk about what resistance means.
So let's be also clear that the attack on universities is due to the fact that universities are centers for defending democracy. Students have always been, since World War II, the anti-war protesters. They protested Vietnam. Last year, they protested the war in Gaza. They protested the Iraq war. So you have to target universities because, as Bangladesh showed, that the students can overturn, are the main enemies of authoritarianism. The Weiße Rose, the White Rose, they showed that students, they were students, and they showed how students provide the center of resistance. And that is also a central reason why authoritarians attack universities.
So as you look at what's happening in this country right now, when we talk about the erasing of history, do you see a preemptive acquiescence that is taking place? And as you heard our last discussion, what do you think university presidents should be doing? We quoted the president of Mount Holyoke, but actually, very few presidents have spoken out right now.
That's right. It used to be that our presidents were supposed to speak out in favor of democratic values. Now, university presidents are being told, oh, you have to preserve your institutions. Guess what? Universities are core democratic institutions. Preserving your institutions means speaking out for core democratic values. If you're not speaking out for core democratic values, you're not protecting your institutions, which are core institutions of democracy. So you might have an institution that has the same name that's still called Yale University, but it is no longer that institution.
Jason Stanley, I want to thank you for being with us. Author and professor of philosophy at Yale University, his new book, Racing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Also author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And we'll link to your articles that you have written in response to what's happening right now in this country. Coming up next, the head of the lever, David Sirota, on what the Democrats are doing to resist what is taking place, or what they're not doing. Stay with us.
I am a dove. We'll be right back.
Thin Air by Julie Felix. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 1 month into Donald Trump's second presidency, he's mostly governed through executive orders and carried out his agenda with sweeping cuts by the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, the billionaire, and his so-called Department of Government Efficiency, all of which has generated a slew of protests, lawsuits, judicial rebukes. This week, Trump shared an illustration of himself wearing a crown with the headline, "Long Live the King." It looked like a Time magazine cover as he cheered his administration's move to end congestion pricing in New York. On Tuesday, Elon Musk defended his work to gut whole agencies across the federal government in a joint interview with President Trump on Fox News.
I think what we're seeing here is the sort of the thrashing of the bureaucracy as we try to restore democracy and the will of the people.
Meanwhile, a court filing from the White House Office of Administration lists Elon Musk as a senior advisor to the president who's serving as an employee of the White House office, not DOGE, which the White House previously said he was leading. To discuss this and much more, as Elon Musk holds up a chainsaw at the CPAC summit that just took place, we're joined by David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever, former senior communications advisor and speechwriter for Bernie Sanders. His recent pieces for The Lever headlined, "Trump just limited your payout for airline mishaps. Elon doesn't want you to know his DEI past. And Musk just scored more government cash while pushing education cuts." Well, you're here for a big podcast convention. You were talking about climate. But talk about what's happening right now and the level of resistance.
I think what we have to understand is that the question that we have to ask is, why is Donald Trump behaving the way he's behaving when his party already controls Congress and the courts? What is the point of trying to do what he's doing without going through the normal process of legislating? Right? If you want to close down the Department of Education, if you want to close down the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the way to try to do that is through legislation, through passing it through Congress, having the law upheld in court. His party controls those institutions. So why hasn't the White House tried to do that through the normal process? And I think if you step back, what you see is what they're trying to do is create the precedent that a president can do whatever a president wants, that it's not a co-equal branch of government, that essentially it is a king, an elected king. And I think they're relying on the idea that people, or at least their base, doesn't necessarily know or care about what the difference between a president in a co-equal branch of government is versus an elected monarch. They're trying to create a precedent that presidents cannot be constrained at all.
And your response to Elon Musk saying, we're talking about the thrashing of the bureaucracy as we try to restore democracy. I mean, you watch Fox and all they're talking about is laughing about people getting doged. They're cutting the fat out. You're not hearing about what the services are that are being slashed, sliced and diced across this country.
This is an old tactic. This reminds me of the Gingrich era. Newt Gingrich, when he rose to power in Congress, would come out and pick out one or two science projects that sounds on its face ridiculous. Oh, the government's spending $2 million to study cow flatulence. Oh, this means that the entire government is wasteful. Meanwhile, there's a reliance that there's not an understanding of what scientific research ends up developing. And I think they're applying that across the board. And we have to ask the question, well, why? The richest man in the world is also one of the largest government contractors. So there's an inherent conflict of interest, or in the case of the Trump administration, I guess, an alignment of interest. The more you cut public services, the more it creates essentially the impetus to hire private contractors, and the guy who's doing the overseeing of the cutting happens to be one of the largest private contractors.
You recently said on social media, quote, it's not really a political party at this point. It's better understood as a country club with status perks for its emeritus leaders. And referring to the Democratic Party in response to news that former VP presidential candidate Kamala Harris had signed with CAA to represent her on her post-White House initiatives, including speaking engagements and possible book deals.
Look, the Democratic Party doesn't seem to be interested in changing, at least not yet. They reelected their same leaders who oversaw the policy and party positioning that led to Trump's re-election. That's the same leadership that led to Trump's first election in 2016. The party doesn't seem interested in changing how it approaches its own voters or its own effort to win elections. There's some lip service to the middle, to the working class, but there's not really a change in policy.
What do you make of Senator Sanders now going around the country and speaking in red districts that are most vulnerable? He says if we can turn around three, he says, they've ended their extremely narrow lead in the House.
Yeah, look, I think Bernie Sanders is doing the right thing. It's an example of what the Democrats at large should be doing, which is actually going into and trying to speak to the disaffected working class that used to be the base of the Democratic Party. The problem is that the Democratic Party, its leaders are caught between the demands of their donors and the demands of voters, which is why so often the Democratic leadership sounds incoherent. If you're trying to address what voters want, but also trying to enrich or appease your donors, you often sound like you stand for nothing. I mean, can we actually explain or answer the question, what do the Democrats stand for right now, other than, in theory, rhetorically being against Trump, even though they're giving votes to confirm some of his nominees? I think the average person has trouble even articulating what is the Democratic Party for? What does it support? What does it advocate for? There's not really much of an answer right now.
You had a recent piece on Elon Musk's previous support for DEI policies at Tesla.
Yeah, well, look, only a few years ago, Tesla was touting itself as weaving DEI into its DNA. That's a quote out of a large report that came out from Tesla. Obviously, the politics have shifted. Donald Trump is trying to demonize DEI as a way to appeal to the working class. And the Democrats haven't made an effective argument on economics to also try to appeal to the working class. And right now, if both parties aren't really making an economic appeal, then Trump is relying on making an identity appeal.
You, in this last 20 seconds, what do you think is most important right now?
The most important thing is for the Democrats to try to gum up the works, to stop what's going on. They don't have a lot of power. And it's also important to understand that if Donald Trump is going outside of the institutions of government, then the Democrats are going to have to rely on different kinds of tactics that don't just rely on just press conferences in the U.S. Senate.
Do you think it's possible Republicans in the House and Senate will turn on Trump?
I don't believe it's going to happen. There's no historical precedent for the Republicans to bail out on their own president.
David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever. We want to thank you so much for being with us, and we will link to your articles at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
What is the forest industry most afraid of? Shifting the conversation from saving old growth to protecting what's left of BC's primary forests, areas with minimal human disturbance and far greater ecological value than tree farms. Save What's Left Conservation Society is a volunteer-run group at the forefront of the movement to save the last remnants of unprotected primary forest through seeking reforms to the government agency, BC Timber Sales. Learn more at savewhatsleft.ca, find us on social media, and please support our vital work through our website.